never truly cared. Never hurt the ones who love me. Now I'm still risen king. I've taken the low road. If you've done the same, meet me down there by the train. Down there by the train. Down there.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Rula Jabral and Julian Schnabel, the writer and director of the new film Miral. Rula Jabral is a journalist who grew up in East Jerusalem and went to study in Italy, where she was a journalist for 12 years before moving to work at a television station in Cairo. Her autobiographical novel, Miral, is the basis of the film now out in theaters. Julian Schnabel is an artist and filmmaker. His works of art are displayed in museums worldwide, and his films, including Basquiat, The Before Night Falls, and The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, have won critical acclaim and box office success. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rula Jabral and Julian Schnabel.
Good morning.
Thank you.
And let me begin with you, Julian. It seems to me that it's very necessary, I think, the choice that you made to tell the history of this tortured relationship between the Israeli and Palestinians, you know, starting from the point of view of how the state of Israel was created and the notion that in order to solve a European refugee problem, an Arab refugee problem was created. And it seems to me that that's necessary to attract a younger generation of an audience, because our education system is such that I don't think the history is accessible. So I'm kind of curious as to why there have been some complaints from reviewers about the history, because that is the history from which the characters emerge.
It is amazing, but I think that what I forget sometimes is that people really do come to this issue with preconceptions and essentially the Leon Uris narrative, subliminally, I think that people have kind of been blinded by the mere existence that this point of view would even exist, and let alone be talked about. Do you want to say something before I continue?
No, go ahead.
I didn't even realize it myself. I mean, because the Exodus narrative is something that, you know, I was weaned on. I was in the Rivoli Theater with my parents seeing Exodus on Broadway, and everybody stood up and put their hands on their hearts when they sang HaTikvah. And it's wonderful to have a Jewish homeland in Israel. But the only way to have a Jewish homeland is for the homeland to be a home to everybody that lives there. And Jewish people can't have rights that Palestinian people don't have, or that Israeli Palestinians, Arab Israelis, don't have. And that seems to be a mandate that exists in the United States of America and supposedly in the state of Israel. So for me, a Jewish person who is an American Jewish person, whose mother was the president of Hadassah and was a devout Zionist, and I also believe that the state of Israel needs to exist, but the only way we're going to exist is if we're benevolent, understanding, and give the Palestinians the same kind of respect and dignity that we expect as Jewish people.
And Rula Jabral, you are an Israeli, right? You grew up in Haifa and East Jerusalem.
I am Palestinian. I was born from a Palestinian family, and I happen to my parents, both of them, are Palestinians. And my sister was born in Jerusalem. She didn't have an Israeli passport, and I happened to be born in Haifa, and I had an Israeli passport. But my identity, my roots, and my family, my ethnic group is Palestinian. And, you know, it's incredible that when I hear you talking about why people here react to this, this is the kind of taboo that you can see about certain issues, and one of them is the Palestinian issue. And we've been always denied to be part of the dialogue about what's going on in the Middle East. The only voices that you heard and you would hear in the media here is the Israeli voice. It's never happened in the history that you've heard or you read or you watch a narrative of a Palestinian person. That's why it's shocking for some people. But you cannot have any kind of solution for the Middle East if you don't include this point of view. That's why I think Julian is really courageous to bring this issue up and hold up a mirror to both sides, showing them what the reality is, and actually break this wall of silence.
Break the what?
The wall of silence.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear.
And that is a peculiar kind of wall, Rula Jabral, because it's sort of an enforcement of one version of reality. And for many decades, I've conducted discussions between Israelis and Palestinians, and I also hosted the fellows that wrote the book about the Israel lobby, and tremendous contention, and had to deal with all kinds of anger. But from the Israeli side, the American Jewish side, it was basically, you either accept our reality or you're an anti-Semite, and it's very offensive. And
it is very offensive, very disturbing. But you know what? I lived in a place where, in order to survive, I had to have an education. And the first thing that you learn, the first through the education, to become a critical thinker, and that brings you to actually criticize everything around you, government, social behavior, political behavior, in a way. And that's supposed to be the essence of a democracy. When I lived in Italy, everybody was criticizing the government every day. But that's what made the government actually force the government to address certain issues like mafia, like corruption. In the United States, we every day see people criticizing, you know, on papers and as journalists, writers, or TV anchors, criticizing government. Does that make us become anti-American or anti-democratic? Actually, this dynamic helps not only the civil society, it helps, you know, the government to understand that what they are doing is affecting the result.
The effect on regular people.
Exactly, has effect on regular people. And Israel has to admit and has to understand that this is a dialogue that you have in a democracy. You cannot live in a democracy and behave like you are a regime. When you go to Cairo, and I went and I worked in Cairo, we were denied, and we were actually, many times I was censored because I criticized the government or even raised questions about their behavior.
I think you're making a very valid point, and I feel in many ways that the film does a great educational service, not just in terms of the historical context it's established out of which the characters and the story emerges, but also I think because there has been this kind of enforcement of one particular reality. And I've noticed over the years that the Europeans have drifted away from their original support for Israel, and unless this film and this debate is met with a certain level of equanimity and tolerance, my problem with the dealing with this agony and trying to bridge these gaps by having these conferences over the years is that it's sort of descending into a kind of competition of victimhood.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And, you know, I was talking yesterday, we give these Q&As after the movie, and I've thought about this a lot more certainly than I ever have before. And I know there's one thing that's true, that is that every Israeli and every Palestinian have in common, and that is they all want their children to come home at the end of the day from school. And not one of them is guaranteed that their kid's going to come home, because whether it's a stray bullet from a soldier or a suicide bomber, something's going to get through that wall. You cannot make peace by building a wall around people. You have to open the hearts of people. And I know it sounds like a cliche, but it's really a cliche for a reason. We need to If we don't accept that there's a dialogue rather than a monologue, unfortunately, our voices are going to get drowned out because there's so many other people that are surrounding the state of Israel that also want democracy and that are getting it. There's a peaceful revolt that occurred in Egypt, in Tunisia, and it's spreading all over the Arab world, and it's all over the Middle East. And, you know, in 1987, when the Intifada started, this was the same thing. It was a peaceful demonstration. It started out being peaceful, and it became exacerbated into a war. When our movie stops, before our movie ends in 1994, there were no suicide bombers. There was no Hamas. And the settlements have been, again, the word exacerbated to an unholy number. And at first it was the notion of religious people thinking they needed to live in Hebron. Now it's just people finding cheaper rent. They have no political, they have no religious reason necessarily for doing this. They're just, according to Sharon's quote, grab everything, because whatever you don't grab is left for them. And unfortunately now, and it's all about demographics, and unfortunately now, in the movie it says that there was 22% of the land that they would accept. Well, there's not even 5% of the land left. So essentially, is it even possible to have a two-state solution? When the girl says, why can't we live in a democracy where everybody has the same rights, like in New York City, it sounds a little bit like out of the mouths of babes, but isn't that what everybody in the Mideast has been saying? And actually, something I find extremely disturbing is that, you know, I think Obama is a good man, and I voted for him, and I would vote for him again. But I am so disappointed where, on one hand, he makes this great speech that really infused the Egyptian people with enthusiasm and a sense that they could have a democracy, and then he'll get up. And I can't believe that he actually means what he's saying when he vetoes the illegality of the new settlements. And it's a real tragedy that the Vogel family was killed. I mean, it's a tragedy, but that's no excuse for saying, okay, we're going to build another 500 settlements. I mean, that's not I can't think of a world leader or a statesman that would make that kind of declaration in regard that it seems totally irrational. And there's one other thing. Is yesterday a man came to me before I even saw the movie, and he said, you know, he thinks that the Israelis are just trying to protect themselves because they keep getting rockets sent from Gaza. And, you know, I don't think he understands that if the Israeli government would take the settlers out of Hebron, there's 1,000 settlers in the middle of 160,000 Palestinians in Hebron that are terrorizing these people, that are terrorizing the Palestinian population to move out of their houses. I've seen, which made me ashamed, kids with payas and yarmulkes throwing rocks into a Palestinian person's house, throwing a rock and hitting a Palestinian person in the head while two soldiers stand by, do nothing, and watch. I've seen Israeli soldiers that are supposed to be protecting the settlers walk children, Palestinian children, to school through a graveyard at night so they don't get beat up on the way to school. And I find that very confusing. And I think that the American public needs to know what's happening there. We can't, it's a lawless place, and we can't bully these people around. And, you know, there's a million and a half people living in Gaza in an open-air prison. You wonder why they're angry.
Let me remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with writer and director of the new film, Miral, Rula Jibreel, and Julian Schnabel. Rula Jibreel, polls indicate for the longest time that the majority of Israelis, up to 70%, want peace. And there has been some polling in the Palestinian Authority and even on the Hamas side that indicates an equal number on the Palestinian side. And if you poll the American people, they come out at about 60 to 70% in favor of peace. So given those numbers, what is driving the minority to maintain this unacceptable status quo?
Well, the minority, they keep the power. I mean, we listen, I don't know what I mean, we. The Israeli government on one side, the Palestinian Authority, they are forced by these minorities to answer to the other side, to the other minority. For example, Bibi Netanyahu is held hostage by his minority in the government, and they are the ones that telling him, who are, you know, the Shas and other parties that are telling him, okay, if you will stop the settlements, you will not have any more government because you will not have numbers in the parliament. So in order to keep to stay in office, he has to please these people. And he's pleasing them on the cost of not making peace happen, on the cost of the majority of the Israeli people that want peace. From the other side, the Palestinian Authority has a very big problem with Hamas. Hamas is somebody that is a movement that was that became extremist. And you know what? If you study the history of Hamas, you understand that the fail of politics, the fact that the Oslo Agreement was killed, empowered extremist groups, especially Hamas, because they became as an alternative. Hamas came with a slogan in 2000 saying, the Palestinian Authority for a long time didn't achieve anything from Israel through peace negotiation. Give us power, vote for us, and we will bring you back your rights by fighting. I think when you really kill a peace agreement, when you dehumanize a whole nation, when you push leaders like Abu Mazen, who is a real Democrat, and he was willing more than one time to sign any kind of agreement that guarantee a little bit of future democracy and freedom for his country. For years, he was waiting on the door, and the Israelis said, yes, finally, we have a good partner. We have a good partner. Finally, Arafat is out of the, you know, he's out, he's dead. So now we will make peace because finally we find the right man. They never gave him anything. That really made Abu Mazen look like an idiot, like somebody that is not capable of bringing results. That's how Hamas actually became more powerful. And let's be honest, the corruption in the authority made it harder. But there's one thing that we forget to say. In 1993, when Rabin signed that agreement, he said a beautiful sentence. He said, I am making peace with the Palestinians because I know that we need to move forward and I need to see a future for my country. 3 years later, that same man said, I am the only one that made peace. I'm not talking about it. He was shot in the head after he left that stage. 3 bullets killed him. And from that moment, we heard 7 Israeli prime ministers saying, we will talk about peace, we will talk about peace. But none of them made anything toward, really concrete steps toward that process. And
I mean, how many settlements have been established since 1993, since the end of the Oslo Agreement?
Yeah, the Oslo Agreement, there was 50 settlements. In 2000, actually, now there are 200 settlements. That means that, and even, you know, if you consider not only the number of the settlement, the number of settlers, there used to be 200,000. Today there are 500,000 living in the West Bank, in the occupied territories. And these things, they don't help, actually. We forget that these things give the Palestinian one sign, that we will never accept any agreement, we will take more and more land, and you will always live as a guest.
Well, of course.
And a second citizen in your own country.
Sure.
If you think of the wall, you know, the border between Israel and Palestine is 380 kilometers, and the wall is 690. So you think why it has to be double? Simply because it goes inside and annexes other land to Israel. And, you know, this is the attitude. This is what nobody talks about in this country.
Well, of course, also what people don't talk about is that there was a period after the Oslo Accords were signed when Israelis could buy furniture in Bethlehem, gamble in casinos in Jericho, and there was a display for all to see that peace is possible and it worked. That's the great tragedy that we've gone back in time. But let me ask Julian Schnabel about just going back to the film as opposed to the to the politics of the situation.
Good.
It really does. It really catches. It caught up on me emotionally. It just was a slow sort of build, and in the end, at the very end, the funeral, and of course that wonderful scene with the woman who runs the orphanage, and the main character played by this beautiful Indian actress, the
Frida Pinto.
Yeah, talking about "You're My Hope," and then the funeral procession. In the end, it just absolutely overwhelmed me. And what the scenes where she becomes politically motivated, your character, Rula.
Miral, right?
Miral, when the house is demolished, it really does feel like a person. I mean, I think it conveyed the pain. An object almost became a person.
Yes, I'm glad you felt that way. I think that the whole subject of rape is key to this movie. I mean, Nadia is raped because of the collapse of society. When that building is knocked down, it's the rape of the whole notion of land and of home. And when you see a Catherine Deneuve raped in her in Repulsion, and you see the Israelis watching the movie, they're becoming the victims of this suicide attack, this terrorist attack. At the same time, they are participating as voyeurs in this rape. So it's, I think sometimes there's so many histrionics, and there's so many supposedly logical excuses or rebuttals or attacks and points of view that come from this, what I said, the actually just subliminally assimilating the Leon Uris narrative, that people are looking for, and when they see the stock footage, or they say, why didn't you include this or why didn't you include that? My job was to tell Rula's story, about Rula's memory, about Rula's antecedents, a psychogenetic portrait, all of the people that informed who she was. So by the time this girl shows up and sees this house getting knocked down, you understand who she is, what her response is, and why she would behave the way she does. And I think many film critics are looking for a more understandable or linear and logical narrative that would be the more standard or Hollywood way of telling a story, which I have no interest in doing. And I see this, even in our conversation as we sit talking on the radio, there's so much information, there's so many, there's so much blood running high in emotions and with positivistic kind of heels dug into the ground, that it's impossible to see this story in an objective way. That's the inexhaustible, complete version of which everybody's asking for of this drama. But what you can do, or what I can do, is see it in a subjective way and talk about it in an magic way and deal with it in an expressionistic way and take my feeling for a human being, the feeling that Rula gave me because of the relationship and the love that she had with her father, the forgiveness that she had for her mother, the forgiveness that Hind had for her when she disobeyed Hind's rules, the contradiction in Hind saying no politics, but at the same time sending the girls to see the refugee camps so she's making them aware. And what I tried to do was to just show the different vivid moments in somebody's memory, in somebody's psyche, and bring the audience into a personal relationship so where they would empathize with this character. Then finally, the notion of, and the feeling is, they do empathize with this character, they walk out of the movie theater and they care. And then as they say to themselves, am I supposed to care about this person? This person's supposed to be the enemy. But now they have a face, you realize that her father has a different take on life than Hani, and that Hind is different than Nadia and Fatima, and they're all Palestinians, but they're all different people. And sometimes people say, oh, the text is stiff, or there's people don't talk like that when they're kissing. Well, I'd like to dare anyone to go and live in that environment for a while, and you see what people talk about every day, and you cannot remove that omnipresent discussion from every personal moment. One line in the movie that I love is when Miral says to Lisa, "Are you in the army?" What other country does a girl meet a girl at a beach party and ask her if she's in the army? Because, I mean, so I think that it's what I'm very pleased with is that there is a controversy. People are waking up. I think Jewish people actually want to be part of the conversation with other Jewish people now because they want to know what this is all about. Is there a problem with what we've been thinking? Do we need to consider this? I mean, 63 years, and we're no closer to making peace than we were a long time ago. So I think that the notion that we're able to show this movie at the United Nations and that people didn't want us to show this movie and that there's so much, I mean, something is breaking here. There is something that's opening up, and I mean...
Well, let me ask Rula just in the last minute then to pick up on what Julian just said, because it seems to me, given the contagion of democracy spreading throughout the Middle East, a revolution led by young, tech-savvy, globally hooked up young Arabs, the Palestinian papers, Al Jazeera revealed recently, do show that the young Palestinians have every reason to be in the streets against their government, as the Egyptians do. Is there anything happening on the Israeli side as well? Do you think that there is a possibility that this film might be a catalyst for a generational shift in thinking?
I hope so. I have to tell you, watching the Arab world these days, these months actually, is what we've been waiting for our entire life. I saw it happening, working in Italy and working in Egypt, watching what was happening in Tunisia, in Syria these days. It was impossible for these nations to stay oppressed for so many years without standing up and raising their voice, saying, enough is enough. Now we want to be protagonists in our own country's destiny. We want to be part of the politics. We want to share, and we want democracy and freedom. This is what the Palestinians did in 87, and this is what they are doing these days. Nobody's covering this, but they went to the streets for a week, and they were saying three things. No Hamas, no Palestinian Authority, no corruption in the Palestinian Authority, and no military presence, no Israeli military presence in the West Bank. And I think until we don't listen to them, nothing will change. The thing that changed South Africa was two things. One, that the South African government, Leclerc, was forced to re-examine his politics by the international community. And second thing is reconciliation. What we are trying to do with this movie is open a debate, a dialogue, where we look at each other and we try both to examine what is going wrong and why our mistakes cannot hold us back from finding a solution. And until we don't admit that there's, you know, brutality, oppression, there's racism, and there's only one option was used on the, you know, in this country, which is only the military option and violence, until that moment comes, we will never find a solution. And yes, I feel that this movie is a small step, but that can open people's eyes about their own country, their own people. I mean, when Jewish people in New York see this movie and they have been supporting Israel their whole entire life, and they will go on supporting it, but now they might support it in a critical way, saying, you know what, instead of putting this money to build settlements, $3 billion every year, instead of putting to build settlements, why don't you do something else? Why don't you really engage again in negotiation? Why we need to keep soldiers in the occupied territories? Maybe we can get some for better results.
Well, I thank both of you so much for joining us here today on Background Briefing, Rula Jibrail and Julian Schnabel. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Rula Jibrail, who wrote the novel Mural, and Julian Schnabel, who directed the new film based on the novel. The film is now out in theatres. Well, let me think about what we learned today on the Background Briefing. First of all, we've got an update on what's going on in Japan, or what we think is going on in Japan, because both the Japanese government and the Tokyo Power, TEPCO, have been very, very sparse in laying out information. There's been a lot of contradiction and reports that have been come out and then been reversed. I think in general, talking to a specialist on nuclear power from the Union of Concerned Scientists, it's obvious that this is much, much worse than anybody's admitting, and there are hundreds of tons of highly contaminated radioactive water that nobody knows what to do with, and it's quite possible that at least one or three of these reactors have been breached, allowing incredibly toxic materials to be exposed to the atmosphere, and it'll take years for these things to cool down. So we got a brief update on, as much as we know, in general, just letting people know that the story's not over and it's likely to get worse. And then we move to Syria, where it does appear that this ossified and entrenched regime of the Assad family that had emergency rule declaration for 35 years, I think, their regime may be coming to an end. Interesting enough, the U.S. and Israel and other countries are concerned. They're not welcoming this trend because of possible chaos, and which may impact the so-called peace process. Since there is no peace process between Israel and Palestinian, that seems like a specious argument. But James Galvin, a specialist on Syria, made it pretty clear that he thought that this regime was unwinding, particularly because a lot of the demonstrations are taking place in the Assad family's hometown, which is a real surprise. But of course, in recent months and weeks, we've been caught by surprise in all kinds of areas of the Middle East that we thought were condemned to perpetual dictatorship. So that was an interesting revelation. But the long conversation that I had with the filmmakers of this wonderful new movie, Mural, Julian Schnabel, the director, and Rula Jibrail, the writer, and of course the film is based on Rula Jibrail's autobiographical novel about her life growing up in as an Israeli-Palestinian in a divided land where there's little agreement on everything and anything, including history. The film does set the historical context, which some critics have complained about, because everybody has read the same stupid book about writing screenplays, and they feel that everything should happen predictably. And the point of the film is it's her story. And the stuff that people objected to is actually true. So I'm surprised at a lot of the reviewers, because the film just blew me away. And it's a very, very powerful film. It catches up on you in the end, the full weight of the pain of the story, which for the first time tells a Palestinian perspective on life in Israel and Palestine. And I think this is a very brave filmmaker, Julian Schnabel. And he, of course, grew up in a very Jewish family in New York. And he's obviously gone through a kind of transition, perhaps to do with his new girlfriend, this rather beautiful Palestinian woman who is played by an equally beautiful Indian actress from Slumdog Millionaire. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, this is a film, a must-see film, and it may well start a debate and get us past this this kind of one-sided notion that there's only one narrative and you have to stick to that, otherwise you're an anti-Semite, which is unfortunately a lot of the impression that I've gotten so far from those hardline supporters of Israel, and it's deeply offensive to be wanting to find a way out of this terrible and intractable confrontation that's dominated the politics and headlines in the world for so long. And anybody who who's trying to do that is somehow suspect. That's completely unacceptable. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. You can go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You may leave comments, and I'd love to know what you think. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.